I kissed her before she got out of the car. She kissed me back. It had begun. As I was heading into the 2009-2010 season with the Rangers, I wanted summer never to end so that I could just enjoy life with Hillary. And yet, I also wanted to get back on the ice and prove to myself that I was a better player than ever. I even believed that my relationship with John Tortorella could be saved, because I was coming back to play my best season yet. I'm also excited to have Hillary see me play. Obviously, she knows that hockey is what brought me to New York, and that my success at it is what allows me to rent massively expensive airplanes and fly her to music festivals. It will be nice to have her see what all the fuss is about when we walk down the street and grown men come up to me, barely able to get the words out as they ask to shake my hand. And part of the reason I've connected so well with the fans is that New Yorkers have discovered that they never need to ask me if they can shake my hand. I consider myself a guest in their city and hope to stay as long as I can. Even though Hillary was a varsity-level field hockey player in high school, she's never seen an ice hockey game before. The first one she sees me play is against the Ducks in early October. I get an assist in our 3-0 shutout of Anaheim, and contrary to what Hillary thinks will happen, I do not get into a fight. I don't even get a penalty. But I can see the pride in her eyes after the game when she tells me that hockey is the most exciting sport she's ever seen. I think this is all going to work out, with Hillary at least. With Tortorella, I'm having my doubts. Even after being one of the top 3 conditioned guys in the club at training camp, I feel like I'm fighting for a job. I knew something was up when we had our media day for the Rangers to film promo packages for home games and interviews with all the local outlets, and I was an afterthought. Not front and center before the fans who chanted my name at MSG, but kind of, oh, it's okay, we have it covered. I had an idea this was coming because Tortorella told me when camp started that I was to stop being the center of attention on this team. I wasn't trying anything of the sort. I'd brought my personality to the team. We had won with me in the lineup, and I had connected with the fans here more than in any place I'd ever played. But the NHL discourages individuality because they like to control things, and Tortorella was cut from the controlling cloth. He did everything in his power to deter guys from meeting their pre-Torts endorsement obligations, as well as signing new endorsements. He would even put bans on when we could do personal autograph sessions. The reason I know this is that ESPN the magazine wanted to do a feature on me, and Torts said no. I would never have known had I not gone to the ESPYs in LA and run into the editor who'd made the ask and who told me about it. I was furious, but I had my revenge. I told Tortorella that I was going to do media that I'd already booked, and I did. As long as my media gigs didn't conflict with a game or practice, then it was my business and not theirs. It was another bullseye on me as far as Tortorella was concerned. And so began my daily battle of trying not to be run out of town by a little man who was scared of the power I held with the Rangers. He'd be on me for everything. He even tried to get me to stop fighting because he was so afraid of momentum that he didn't want to risk upsetting the other team and motivating them. Tortorella was a guy who coached to tie and hoped Hank would be the difference in goal. We all hated it. And even a guy like Ryan Callahan, who flourished under Tortorella, hated it, because his body was falling apart under Tortorella's regime. He'd make guys block 20 shots a game, and then do it again the next night. There are days now when I look back and think I should have walked into Glenn Sather's office and said, let's get me out of here and save us a lot of headaches, because I could see the future. But I also had this hope that I could change Tortorella's game. I missed the first 4 games of the season with a knee injury and had 1 assist in my first game back against Anaheim, which we won 3-0. I also had 10 minutes and 42 seconds of ice time. In the next game against Toronto, I scored 2 goals in our 7-2 win and had 10 minutes and 38 seconds of ice time. Under Tom Rennie, I was playing nearly 20 minutes a night. I've always been realistic when it comes to assessing myself, and I know what's going on here. Tortorella is sending me a message. I also know I should be getting more ice time than my new teammates Chris Higgins and Alice Kotelik and Enver Leeson, to name a few. Every season you have new teammates who present an opportunity to form relationships that sometimes become strong bonds away from the rink long after the game has finished. But my best ones are my old ones. Shanny's now playing across the river in New Jersey, and I see him a lot. And while Nordy's not in the league anymore, we stay in touch. Whenever Chelly comes into town, we hang out. He likes to go to the Russian Baths in the East Village, which is straight out of the film Eastern Promises. There are lots of scary Russian guys with mafia tats everywhere, but no one tries to knife us in the steam room. It's probably Chelly's favorite place to go, other than his chili bar in Detroit. And sometimes you get a teammate whose only lasting impression is something you would rather forget. This is the case with Donald Brashear, who came in to replace Colton Orr as our tough guy. Everyone loved Colton, who had signed as a free agent with Toronto, and he was especially missed by the fans who didn't like Brashear from the start, as Brash had imprinted himself in their memories as a tough guy with arch-enemy Philadelphia and most recently Washington. Our problem with him was simpler. Donald Brashear had halitosis, the medical term for bad breath. Brash could clear a room out with his breath, and if you were the unlucky guy sitting beside him on the bench, you would immediately call for the Rangers trainer, Jim Ramsey, so that he could apply some Vicks VapoRub under your nose to mask the death rays coming from Brashear. On every team I've played on, there have been dog lovers, but Brashear took this to a new level. I was in the weight room when Billy, an ex-NYPD horse cop who took care of our practice rink, rushed in. He had a very dry, biting sense of humor, and he'd seen everything. He now had the kind of look on his face that suggested he hadn't seen this, like maybe aliens had landed in the shower. He told me I had to see it too, so I hurried off, expecting to clock which teammate was shaving his line mate's ass or back, which is a regular act of kindness, but nonetheless, always shocking. This time it was much different. Donald Brashear was in the shower, butt naked, and washing his Great Dane's balls along with everything else on that massive beast. Brashear was in a full lather, and so was the dog. I asked Billy if this was the same as a father having a bath with his almost teenage son. I know it's an extreme comparison, but this was one of the weirdest things I had ever seen in a dressing room, and I had seen some things. Every day during my drive to our practice facility in Tarrytown, I'm thinking about what it would mean to leave New York again, especially now that I've fallen in love with Hillary. I've seen many teammates in long-distance relationships, and they don't work. In most cases, someone cheats, and usually it's the guy, and sometimes his girlfriend stays around, but she harbors so much anger that by the time they are together and get married, they hate each other. And because they are finally together, that probably means he's done playing. This is a recipe for disaster. You stay with this person because you're afraid of being alone. But you're not actually together in a way that lets you understand them. Every ounce of their body, every mood they are in, and gives you the emotional knowledge to live together in harmony. If you're at this point, and you add the dilemma of having to find new meaning in your life when your career ends, and you can no longer do the only thing you've been successful at since you were 8 years old, then I can almost guarantee the marriage won't last. And then what? In most cases, it winds up in divorce. And suddenly you have half the money you had when you retired, which is probably not enough to live on for the rest of your life, unless you move to the backwaters of Mississippi. Then it gets really dark, just before it goes completely black. The more I fall in love with Hillary, the more I think about how much I don't want to leave her, no matter how badly hockey is going. This love is the real deal. So is the love I get from Rangers fans. Baseball's Joe Torre put it perfectly when he explained the relationship between the New York fans and El Duque, the great Yankees pitcher Orlando Hernandez. New York fans are not easy to win over, but they connected with him from day one. That pretty much describes my experience here, one that even now can bring tears to my eyes. The energy that New York fans gave me from the very first moment was like a lifeline, keeping me close to them and urging me to do even better on the ice. It's the greatest professional gift that I've ever been given. It's also the reason I didn't walk into Glenn Sather's office and sit down, man to mentor, to ask for a trade. I had 2 years left on my contract after this season. But it was the addiction that I had to Rangers fans in the city, and now Hillary, that was too hard to break. They could send me back to the canyon for months, and that addiction would still be deep inside me. I kept thinking, it's going to be okay. This coach is going to realize I'm a Ranger to my core and want to do my very best. And if he doesn't, then it is what it is, and I'll figure it out once the ride is over. But I didn't want the ride in New York to ever end. We've won 8 and lost 13 since New Year's, and everyone is miserable under the reign of terror that is Torts. Our last game before the Olympic break is on Valentine's Day, and I give Hillary and the Ranger fans my own unique Valentine, because tonight is the only time I've ever scored on an NHL penalty shot, which I was given after being hooked while in the slot with a clear scoring chance. The one thing that you're most nervous about with the penalty shot is that you're going to miss it. The puck's going to roll off your stick, and you're not going to get any shot off. That's the fear. This is in addition to the fact that you're alone at center ice with the puck and with 20,000 people watching you, hoping you'll fail if it's an away game, and that you'll score if you're at home. It's the most nerve-wracking moment you can have. I mean, if you get a breakaway and score or miss, it all happens so fast, you don't even think about it. On a penalty shot, you get about a minute to think about it, and the guys from the other team are shouting trash at me like, hands of stone, you're fucking awful, faggot, and trying to rattle you. At this point in the NHL, the tie-breaking shootout hasn't yet started, so penalty shots are rare and they're a big deal. The ref blows the whistle, and I skate in fast on Tampa's goalie, Mike Smith, fake him to the right, and then swing wide to my left, and he sprawls to recover. I outweight him and roof the puck over him into the net. It's the sweetest feeling you can imagine because you've scored this one all by yourself. The fact that I scored it against Tortorella's old team, the Tampa Bay Lightning, and the fact that it was the first of our 5 straight goals that would give us a much-needed win made me feel a little better, but not much. The game had the same feeling as most games do before a break during the season, but a bit more so because we were going to be off ice longer with the Olympics. Guys' heads are more focused on making their flights to Miami or Vegas or Cabo. Every 4 years, the NHL sends players to the Winter Olympics, and the rest of us get a long siesta. This Olympic break, I was going to spend time with Hillary. We went to a resort in Jamaica with my friend Lawrence Longo and my teammate Aaron Voros and their girlfriends. The place was called The Caves, and it had been founded by Chris Blackwell, the guy who started Island Records. The resort is on the north coast of Jamaica and has these luxury cabins built on top of cliffs. It's very different from the traditional white sand beach Jamaica. So what's an NHLer to do during the break but a little cliff diving from 25 feet up? Hillary was game for it too, and that trip really made me see how, despite her supermodel gorgeousness, she had the soul of an outdoors girl and loved joining into the spirit of the moment, snorkeling, cliff jumping, cave exploring, hanging in the rum bar and sampling the local beverage. I was soon going to be 30 years old, and from that vantage point, it was my opinion that there was no reason why any professional athlete should be married before his 25th birthday. If you noticed I said my opinion, it's because I was really getting tired of taking heat for having an opinion, which is especially discouraged in the world of pro hockey. I was told by everyone from the goal light judge to my agent that I should limit my opinions. And when I'd hear this, I would sometimes laugh it off and sometimes get angry, and occasionally I would try to understand why nobody would ask me why I said these things. I think they didn't ask because they didn't want to hear my reasoning, just in case they agreed with me. But Hillary wanted to know my opinion, and I wanted to know hers. And that was the best thing going by far in a season that was looking increasingly bleak. She would ask me about the team after games and always looked for the positive. When I told her that Tortorella was killing the Rangers, she accepted that as unacceptable and asked me how I could stop him. I told her I was trying to be the best player I could be, but that he didn't seem to understand. She reassured me that even though she was biased, she could see what I brought to the team, and that hearing the fans chant my name at MSG lit her up with joy, and that made me happy too. My entire life wasn't a disaster. I was just having a rough time at work, on a very public stage. As a public figure herself, Hillary knew the pressure, but her wisdom and her ready smile made me believe that good would triumph. There are some good things in my life in addition to Hillary. My sports bar, Warren 77, is considered a complete success. After games, whether we win, lose, or draw, I pull up out front and reenact the famous scene from Goodfellas where Ray Liotta walks to his table, all one camera shot, at the front of some hot NYC supper club, and inside it's filled with diehard fans and beautiful women and high-rolling Wall Streeters and everything else in between. It makes me forget the guy behind the bench. The food is the best bar food I've ever had, and the drinks are cold, and the bar is always open as long as I'm inside. And best of all, it's free for me, as we write it off as a marketing expense. We're on our way to making our initial investment back in the first year. I've shown that I can make a living off the ice once my NHL career is done. Along the way, I've learned things about how to run a bar. Find an honest man, make him your manager, pay him handsomely, and give him a piece of equity in the bar. Cover the top of your basement cooler in glass so the Goldman Sachs guys, or whoever the rich boys are in your town, have a private place to do big lines of blow in privacy. Waitresses need to be hot single chicks who make the clients feel as if anything is possible. Sometimes it is. It's that feeling that keeps drinks and food flowing. Play a lot of Rolling Stones. Let Eddie Vedder drink straight from an $800 bottle of wine after he single-handedly destroys 20,000 people at MSG 2 hours earlier. Never charge a model for anything. Never charge the NYPD for anything. Play a lot of Pearl Jam. Fry your French fries in duck fat. Have Warhol paintings and Diane Arbus photos on the walls. Make sure John McEnroe comes to opening night and Page Six reports it the next day. Never charge the Wolf, aka Harvey Keitel, and indeed, never charge anyone famous. Put Molson Canadian on tap, pay your sales tax on time. I promise that if you follow these steps and tweak them as need be to your town, you can open a successful bar anywhere from Albany, New York, to Zurich, Ontario. We've played 5 games since the return from the Olympic break, and I have a goal and 2 assists. But the team has a record of 1 win and 4 losses. So on March 12th, I'm a healthy scratch from the lineup for a game against Atlanta. We lost the previous game to New Jersey 6-3, and my plus minus was even, and I didn't take a penalty. But I guess I didn't try hard enough for the little guy behind the bench in my 10 minutes and 56 seconds of ice time. It's obvious to anyone who knows the Rangers that I'm in a lose-lose situation. If I play hard, I usually take penalties, and that also usually becomes an advantage in the end. The problem is that the moment I get involved and play the game I want to play, my best game, is the moment the little guy behind the bench tells me to check yourself, as if I'm about to pee on the carpet or something. I'm back for the next game against Philly and score 2 goals in our win. I am easily the best player on the ice, and I think this is the case because I'm playing for myself and most of my teammates and the fans of NYC, but not for the little guy behind the bench. 10 days later, we beat New Jersey in a shootout. After I screen Marty Brodeur on a Brandon Dubinsky goal that ties the game, I delay 1 second before celebrating with my teammates so that I can remind Marty that he's a fucking home wrecker and should be ashamed of himself. When I get back to the bench, I get an earful from Tortorella about talking to Marty, which he makes clear I'm not allowed to do as long as he's the coach. We are currently 5 points out of the last playoff spot and chasing Philly. Most of the team is so nervous we can't think clearly enough to make a creative play, let alone the right play. Anyone who's not on a long-term contract and makes a mistake is told by Torts when they come back to the bench that if they fuck up again, they're going to get run out of town. Who wouldn't be squeezing the stick too tight if that's your coaching model? I can't listen to another word from Tortorella and turn around and tell him to shut the fuck up. I've reached my breaking point with this guy. He tries to yell some more and scare me, but I'm seeing red, and I think he realizes that if he doesn't back off, something might go down. Oh, and by the way, my Corsi rating is great. Corsi measures the number of shots taken while a player is on the ice, for and against. A good Corsi number says that you have possession more often than not. And my Corsi is better than that of very good players on my team, such as Marian Gaborik, Brandon Dubinsky, Brian Boyle, and Chris Drury. Just saying. After that shootout win in New Jersey, we win 5 games, lose 1 in OT, 1 in a shootout, and 1 in regulation time. But we still don't make the playoffs. We finish 1 point behind both Philly and Montreal, and they get the final 2 playoff spots in the East. I know the players are disappointed. The feeling in MSG in April is magic. The grind is fun. And it's all even better in May if you're lucky enough to still be playing. And yet, there's also a feeling of relief among my teammates that we're done. Even if those words are never uttered out loud. It doesn't even have to be said. None of us can stand listening to the mental midget and his big goofy sidekick, Mike Sullivan. Tortorella is a power-hungry control freak, but he's not smart enough to hire a good cop, even one he could play like a violin. If Mike Sullivan had played the good cop, he could still have turned around after meeting with a disgruntled player and told his puppet master JT the details while giving the player some form of relief. Instead, they're only able to bitch and vent to each other. This creates an unhealthy locker room. In the meantime, I am going to enjoy Hillary in the summer. One of the things I love most about Hillary is her love of music, and although she is rarely not smiling, she gets even happier upon hearing a great song that she loves. And seeing her smile makes me smile, and I haven't been doing a lot of that at work. We went to our first Fish concert at a venue on Long Island called Jones Beach. There was total pandemonium in the parking lot even before the show started, and basic insanity the moment the first chord hit. I was hooked a few songs into the show, when massive funk-based freakouts erupted among the 15,000 fans as they let go of any insecurities and danced any way they wanted. It's what I needed after being told to check myself once too often. After the Jones Beach show, we were hooked on Fish and decided to drive to Saratoga Springs to see them play again. I should also mention that most people at Fish shows are in a chemically altered state, and you could call it the secret ingredient. Because the Saratoga concert is inside a national forest, I decide it's the perfect place to trip on acid for the first time. And 20 minutes before the show starts, I pop a white Altoid with a drop of LSD on it into my mouth and make the short walk from the hotel into the venue. Fish opened the show with a bang, the exuberant brother. Whoa, somebody's jumping in the tub with your brother. And I waited and waited and waited until an hour into the show, and then the acid hit me. I've never felt or experienced anything like it in my life. It feels like you're in a movie, watching yourself in these amazing primary colors with everything alive around you, even things that aren't alive. I can only compare it to a scene in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas where Johnny Depp, playing Hunter S. Thompson, arrives in a hotel lobby while he's on an acid trip, and the carpet on which his character is standing comes to life. I must say, he handles the experience much better than I did. Fish is known for throwing curveballs at their fans by playing unusual cover songs, and that night they played one of the weirdest and most intense cover songs I've ever heard. K Katy Perry's I Kissed a Girl. Fish sent my acid trip into a whole new stratosphere. And by the middle of the song, my face felt like it had melted off and my soul was exposed. My arms felt so heavy I could barely lift them to take a drag on my cigarette. And when I finally got my hand in my mouth, the butt was moving like an ocean wave so that I couldn't meet my mouth to pull a drag. The concert was outdoors, and I had to move around to shake off this beast that was hanging on me. So I made my way to the top row where the venue flattens out and looks down on the crowd and the stage. I sat and watched, trying to control my mind. Hillary, who did not drop acid, was next to me being a good companion. To her and everyone else, I looked like I was fine. Maybe my eyes were a little glassy, but I wasn't going to take a flying leap onto the stage. I mean, I could barely move. People are always talking about finding themselves on acid, and I can tell you that the experience is not guaranteed to be a pleasant one. Acid is not a drug for people who are hard on themselves, and more specifically, a person like me who is motivated much of the time by fear. Yeah, I'm driven by fear that the guy beside me is working harder this off-season than I am. Right now, in the midst of this acid trip, it feels like every NHL player is definitely working harder than me. Fear and acid is not a combination I would recommend. And so the snowball effect begins, and for the next 6 hours I try to wrestle this roller coaster of emotions, and also try not to walk into oncoming traffic so the roller coaster stops. And then I finally fall asleep. Hillary is cool with it all. She knows that I live an intense life, and this walk on the edge was something I wanted to try, responsibly. But it's not going to be a regular trip I make. She's not dating a junkie. She's dating a man who loves her even more each day. Chapter 20, The Last Season. On July 1st, the first day of free agent signings for the 2010-2011 season, the Rangers signed Derek Boogaard. Derek is 6'7 and 270 pounds and one of the most feared players in the NHL. I immediately get his cell phone number from the Rangers to text him congrats and welcome him to New York. I'm happy to have him because he's the kind of tough guy who will give us a lot more room on the ice. And he has the reputation of being a much better teammate than the departed Donald Brashear. We also signed my old friend from Los Angeles, Alex Frolov. And I wondered what new Russian beauty he was going to roll into town with. Frolov was a real ladies' man, and though I never could understand the smooth words coming out of his mouth, there wasn't a single married or separated Russian woman who Frolov couldn't seduce in about 45 minutes. And then there was Ruslan Fedotenko, who played for John Tortorella in Tampa Bay and was so far up the coach's ass, you could see his toes dangling between Torts' legs. Fedotenko was a rosy-cheeked Ukrainian who had come to play junior hockey for the Sioux City Musketeers and as a 19-year-old was billeted by a host family. So his host mother, married with two kids a bit younger than him, fell in love with Fedotenko and left her husband for him. She hangs around the Rangers with the other wives and girlfriends, and this is by far the most uncomfortable situation I've ever been in with a team. She's old enough to be the mother of some of the players' girlfriends. She's old enough to be his mother, too. And Steve Ott used to just light him up about it. We were all from junior towns, and so we all knew the billet drill. They were your other family, and not a dating pool. But Fedotenko is still with her, so it's all part of love's strange game. It's funny how fast my last full season in the NHL went. And yet, at the time, it seemed to crawl. In the season opener against Buffalo, Derek Stepan scores a hat trick in his first NHL game. I set up his third goal with a superstar type of pass, a quick backhander from behind the net to Stepan in the slot, and just like that, it's stretching the mesh behind Ryan Miller. It's the kind of play not even Tortorella could miss. I finished the night with 2 assists. And usually when you start the season with a great game, your coach gets excited and wants to ride you along with any other players coming out of the gates strong. I do get a little more ice time, and in the third game, I pick up another 2 assists against Toronto, then another assist against the Devils, and a goal and an assist against Atlanta. We're 8 games in and I have 7 points. All my work is down low below the hash marks, which has become my specialty over the years. I've become great at protecting the puck when I can use my big Paris Hilton-approved butt to shield the puck. It's like holding a ball in your hands and keeping it from someone, twisting your body like a shield and anticipating your opponent's move, rolling your body a millisecond earlier than the attacking player. Think about the rush you get when you're the one keeping the ball away. Then multiply that by 1,000, and that's how I feel when I have a great shift below the hash marks. Despite my own success on the ice, we're only playing 500 hockey. I'm not happy playing for Tortorella because I'm not really playing for him. I definitely don't want to keep hearing his yapping at us on the bench. I realize that if I'm going to make a move, then now is the time because I have leverage with my play and points total. It's the best time to ask Glenn Sather to move me out of New York, but I'm torn because I still believe just a little bit that Tortorella is going to give me the break I deserve. On the other hand, the more I produce, the less he seems to give me. But I'm definitely conflicted. I don't want to leave. I'm head over heels in love with Hillary. New York City makes me happier than I've ever been, and we've started construction on a second restaurant. I have a thriving business and am about to open another. So I suck it up and play on. But even at this early point in the season, I have a bad feeling about what John Tortorella is doing to this team that Glenn Sather has handed to him. I don't think Glenn asked John Tortorella about whom he should and shouldn't sign or trade for. I believe Slats assembles the team he likes on paper, and the guy he hires to coach them is supposed to figure out how to fit the pieces of the puzzle together. So when Derek Bougard showed up 40 pounds over his playing weight and stepped on the track for fitness testing at his first Rangers training camp and barely finished 2 laps, Tortorella was already trying to figure out how to use Bougard as little as possible. He had almost no use for Bougard as a player and showed as little interest in him as a man. Bougard had made it to the NHL because he could fight. We didn't have anyone on the team who'd fought Bougard before he joined the Rangers. So he came in as a kind of mythic character, the boogeyman. In reality, his reputation as a fighter was so intimidating that he didn't have to fight all that much by the time he became a Ranger. In his first NHL season, Boogie fought 16 times, and in the season before he joined us, he fought 9. He'd cut his total almost in half just because guys knew what power he could unleash. Indeed, he was such a dominant fighter and had such a long reach that George LaRocque himself, no slouch in the fight game, opted to retire from pro hockey rather than face the kind of punch that Bougard had landed on Todd Fedoruk, shattering his cheekbone and requiring a rebuild of Fedoruk's face. The Rangers had signed the boogeyman for $6.5 million over 4 years, which is excellent money for a guy who could fight better than he could play. When Bougard got to New York, we all knew that there was going to be a problem with him fitting in beyond his role as a fighter, because he wasn't the most skilled hockey player. There were times when he would trip over himself in practice, just trying to make a standard pass. But we were sympathetic to him, because he was trying so hard. But he did get in shape, and in a game against Washington at MSG on November 9th, 2010, it paid off. The puck bounced over the Capitals' D-man at our blue line, and Boogie took it up the left wing and ripped a slap shot from the top of the circle. The puck blew past goalie Michael Neuwirth, and it was Boogie's first goal since his NHL rookie season. In fact, it ended the longest goalless streak in the NHL at 235 games. We celebrated on the bench like he'd won the Stanley Cup in Game 7 overtime. It was the happiest I've ever seen a team get for a guy scoring a regular season goal. Exactly 1 month later, Matt Karkner hit Derek with a lucky punch right on the button in a game against Ottawa. Boogie landed a couple of punches of his own, but when he finished the fight, he went straight to the dressing room. And we knew that punch must have done damage. Indeed it had, as Derek had a concussion. He also had an aggravated shoulder injury from when he broke his collarbone in junior. Derek also had an addiction to painkillers. The NHL knew about it, and Tortorella probably knew too. If he did, he sure didn't seem to care. As soon as Derek was injured, a new rule came into effect that decreed that injured players who came to the rink had to finish all their medical treatments and conditioning before the healthy players arrived. In other words, Derek was effectively banished from the team. When this rule came in, everyone was scratching their heads thinking, what the fuck is happening here? This isn't fair. I'd never seen anything like this rule, ever. It was unheard of. We felt terrible and talked amongst ourselves about whether we should say something to management. We would see Boogie leaving the rink in the morning as we rolled in for practice, and you could see the pain and the loneliness on his face. This was another punch to the head for Derek, who already felt extremely abandoned before the injury, which was confirmed by the thousands of text messages he would send monthly, more than 13,000 in February 2011. Being separated from the team that was his life only isolated him even more, and with someone struggling like he was with various issues such as alcohol, drugs, depression, and his injury, it sent a very clear message that he wasn't wanted. I talked to him as much as I could. He knew he could pick up the phone and call or text me whenever, and he did. He was a very proud man, and I could tell that being away from the team was killing him. But he couldn't come out and say it. He had to be up at 5 a.m. to get to the rink ahead of us, in addition to trying to recover from his injury. It seemed to me that Tortorella was trying to make life as difficult as he could for Boogie. Tortorella could give two shits about players who can't help him win, whereas great coaches protect their players as long as their names are on his team's roster. I reached my breaking point with how Tortorella was treating Bugard and spoke to many people about it, including the Rangers' assistant GM and assistant coach Jim Schoenfeld. I told Schoenfeld that it wasn't fair what they were doing to this guy, and that he couldn't handle being away from the team. The look on Schoenfeld's face said, as a former player, I know you're right. But what came out of his mouth was what he was supposed to say. Tortorella called the shots, and so it continued. We hated it, and felt guilty that we could not stop the torment of Bugard. But we played on more for ourselves than for that lunatic running the show. On November 14th, the Edmonton Oilers were at MSG, now under the guidance of my old coach, Tom Rennie, who had always been decent to me. Even so, the Oilers had been taking runs at me all night. When I hit Kurt Fraser with a hard, clean hit, we both went down. And when I got back up, the Oilers' Ladislav Smead, 6'4", 210 pounds, was tapping me on the shin pads, wanting to go. We were up 5-2 in the third and had the game in hand, so I didn't want to do anything to jeopardize that. But Smead wouldn't give up. He kept following me around on the ice, tapping me with his stick, hooking my arms and saying, let's fight. Since I have come to believe that, as the great war philosopher Sun Tzu said, all warfare is based on deception. I tell Smead to hold on until we get the puck back, and then we can fight. He's giving me the death stare, but I can tell that he's let his guard down just a little, thinking our scrap is a few seconds in the future. So I flick off my gloves, and my left hand goes for his jersey just under his chin. Now I'm anchored on. The trick is to make sure you pull the other guy toward you. If you just swing like a boxer, you're as likely to topple over as he is. So you use him to give yourself leverage. I give Smead a tug to pull him toward me, then shoot my right fist forward as hard as I can. I timed it perfectly and hit him square on the chin. All 6'4 of him falls instantly, and now the momentum takes me crashing down on top of him. After that, all hell breaks loose, as the Oilers want to kill me, and every guy on the ice gets into a tussle. I get tossed from the game, but we win 8-2. Tortorella isn't happy because any time I do something well or get the crowd on my side, he plays me less. So that was my reward from this master of coaching strategy. My biggest fear is not being able to live in New York, and it's becoming more obvious to me that my days as a New York Ranger are slowly coming to an end. Even though I'm still producing and had a goal and 2 assists in my last 5 games, I get the least amount of ice time of all the forwards on March 15th against the Islanders. After the game, I'm disgusted. But I still have optimism. I figure I can fix this. I've had a few meetings with Glenn Sather about it, but he didn't really have much to say. It was a tough situation for both of us, because he knew I could bring more to the team, but he wasn't going to interfere with a coach's decision. It's what makes him a great GM. But then, GMs have no problem stepping in to fire the coach when the coach's decisions lead to disaster. So the principle of letting coaches self-determine is more than a little flexible. My agent Pat Morris wanted to move me, but I told him to hold off because I really believed, despite the evidence, that Tortorella would have some major revelation behind the bench and I would be back in business. And I believed this because I had always been able to turn around bad situations through will and hard work. I also couldn't imagine leaving New York. But until Tortorella sees the light, real life continues away from the rink. Hillary and my thriving off-ice businesses. Hillary makes me feel complete, and she says I do the same for her. I remember how when I went through the lockout with Rachel, I was a mess. I was so insecure about my future that I think she grew weary trying to reassure me that it would, that I would, turn out okay. I mean, she never said that at the time, but now from the vantage point of 5 years, I can see what I must have been like to live with. Tough sledding, as they say, back in the old country. I can see that I'm a better man with Hillary because I'm not dragging her down with my problems at work. I'm talking to her about solutions, but also about life beyond the arena. I'm not defined just by hockey anymore. It's not a realization that smacks me in the face. It's one that I can see now, looking back. Warren 77 is a success. The thing I was learning about the bar business, though, was that buzz comes faster than profits. So you have to be prepared to hang on. At that moment, I was making about a teacher's salary from the place, and I could have lived on it if I took in roommates. Being a professional athlete has a short shelf life. But if you think about exiting the game while you're still playing it, then you should be able to create opportunities off the ice for yourself. Then you can slide into them once you retire. And that's what I was doing. Given that Warren 77 was going strong, I wanted to maximize that buzz, and so I was starting a new bar and restaurant called Tiny's and the bar upstairs with some partners. John Tortorella got wind of it and called me into his office to ask me about Tiny's, which was 2 months away from opening. I knew right away that the reason for our meeting was to scare me, because Tortorella somehow knew that Henrik Lundqvist was an investor. My guess is that John Rosasco, the head of Rangers PR, told him. Hank was in his only slump since the beginning of the 2009 season, and Tortorella was blaming me and the business for distracting him. He told me that he didn't want me opening the bar and that he didn't want Henrik Lundqvist to be a part of it. I was stunned. A coach was telling me that he didn't want me to do anything outside of his team. He was telling me not to have a personal life. He had no idea how much time I was spending on my private affairs, and if I wasn't playing, practicing, or training, then it was none of his business. He had moved from interfering with our endorsements during the season to trying to take total control of our off-ice time. I've never walked out of a meeting with my head coach, but if I didn't leave the room, I was going to end up in Rikers for choking this little shithead within an inch of his miserable life. If he really believed that Henrik was playing poorly because of Tiny's, then he knew nothing about his star player. Lundqvist was not working at Tiny's. He was investing in it, Players have slumps. Anyone who knows how to coach professional athletes would know how to deal with that. I told Glenn Sather about it, but he had nothing to say, really. He kept a poker face and wasn't going to play his hand. But all he had to do was watch a game. He didn't have to live through playing for a coach who responded to something he didn't like on the ice by kicking water bottles or throwing shit on the bench or tugging on a player's jersey and screaming at him and ripping him a new asshole. I wasn't telling Slats anything he didn't already know. The question was, who would go first, me or Tortorella? I got benched by Tortorella for 5 of our last 12 games as we fought for a playoff spot. One blogger who covers us said that I'd been thrown under the bus by Tortorella so often that I might as well buy the bus and drive it out of town. But of course, I couldn't leave on my own accord. Hillary is as supportive as she can be for someone who's never really been in a situation like this before. And I'm doing a pretty good job of not letting it bother me when I come home, because I don't want it to poison our relationship. But I'm also starting to get used to it. It will not control my life because it will make us both crazy. And Hillary is sane. She loves me. I love her more each day, and I will keep playing my game. It's the one thing I can control on the ice. We made it into the playoffs with the lowest point total of any team that season, 93. I was benched for game 1 against Washington, which we lost in overtime, and then got back in for the final 4. We won just one of them. It was going to be a long summer. Little did I know just how long. In early May 2011, I became the first athlete in any of the 4 major league sports in North America to take a stand on a particular issue. And it was so radical that it surprised me by getting me attention everywhere, both good and bad. Brian Elner, who was the senior strategist for the Human Rights Campaign's successful effort to win marriage equality in New York, contacted me through a mutual friend with a request. And so I did a public service announcement for him in my Rangers jersey in support of marriage equality. What I said on camera was this: committed couples should be able to marry the person they love. Join me in supporting marriage equality. I did this because I was raised by Al and Marlene to treat everyone as I would like to be treated. And I know this was not always apparent on the ice, but as I said earlier, I was playing a villain in a kind of theater. I'm not actually a villain. It seemed a no-brainer that if I could marry whoever I wanted to marry, then everyone else should be able to do the same. At that time, and to this day, no NHL player has come out as gay, and I would stand next to that player as he told his teammates who he was and help him should there be anyone who took issue with it. In fact, no NHLer, nor anyone from any other sport, thanked me for doing it. No player said anything negative to me about it either, but fans certainly did. They would hold up signs in opposing rinks calling me a fag. The referees and the NHL ignored them. The word fag is part of NHL culture and used as common slang. If a guy came into the dressing room wearing a paisley tie, someone would say, "That's a faggy tie." You heard it all the time. Even so, I was just stunned that not one New York professional athlete had stepped up. Who the hell do they think our fans are in any of the sports? Straight white men? Our fan bases are as diverse as our community, though that's not something that really registers with hockey players. But shame on them for hiding in the ostrich culture of pro sports, and the idea that we'll somehow be run out of town if we actually tell the fans that we have lives just like they do. Gay, straight, both. How will this repel people? And if it does, well, here's a chance to educate. The Rangers were great about this. James Dolan, who takes major hits of criticism from the media, had been nothing but a stand-up guy to me all through my time with the Rangers. He had no hesitation in supporting me, and he let me wear the Rangers jersey in the ad. He signed off on it, and didn't feel the need to make a big thing about it or even speak to me about it. In putting the Rangers colors out there in support of the rainbow colors, I saw that Jim Dolan also doesn't play by the old boy rules laid out by NHL owners, and I was proud to be playing for him, however much longer that I lasted here. On Saturday, May 14th, 2011, at 2 p.m., I was home with Hillary and my teammate Aaron Voros when the phone rang. It was the Rangers PR head John Rosasco calling, and he asked me if I was sitting down. My immediate thought was, where have I been traded? Even with the dismal way our season and my season had ended, I wasn't ready to go. I felt a surge of anxiety in my gut. I was right to feel anxious. The news was worse than I thought. Derek Bougard was dead. He had overdosed and died in his sleep the night before. I hadn't seen Derek in a while. At the end of February, he had just started skating to come back to join the team. One morning he showed up at the rink and was so loaded on Xanax and wine that he could barely stand. And yet there he was, out on the ice. I couldn't believe he'd actually made the drive to our practice rink in Tarrytown, given the state he was in. I stormed into Glenn's office and said, someone has to get him off the ice and send him to California. Jim Schoenfeld went out and got him off the ice, and a couple of days later, Boogie was on his way to the canyon. The last conversation I had with the boogeyman was fresh in my mind. As he called me to ask for an introduction to any Los Angeles boxing coaches I knew, along with a good trainer who could help him work on his foot speed. He also wanted some advice on his next couple months of life in rehab. NHL players have great healthcare coverage, probably the best healthcare coverage on the planet. Derek was in the league's substance abuse and behavioral health program, which was almost always required when a player had discipline issues or a problem not associated with hockey. The best part about the program is that everything is paid for, from your therapy, both mental and physical, to your yoga lessons, to any medical expenses, including rehab, which can cost up to $70,000 a week. I told Derek to take full advantage of this, to stay out in sunny California for the entire off season, to get healthy and train so that he'd be ready for camp in a few months. I think I was one of the few guys on the team he felt comfortable speaking with about his issues. I'd always told him never to hesitate in calling me any time that he needed to talk, and I even gave him Hillary's cell phone number just in case he couldn't reach me. I kept stressing how great an opportunity it was to be able to spend those months in California. I knew Derek had recently broken up with a girl he was dating and was trying to do the right thing and stay in Cali so that he could move on from a relationship that seemed a bit destructive. The combination of not playing the second half of the season, being cut loose from the team by Tortorella, and breaking up with his girlfriend put Derek in a bad place. Derek had been given permission to leave rehab and fly home to Minnesota for his sister's college graduation. He relapsed into a night of drinking with his friends and brothers and finished it off with some Percocet. He never woke up. He was a week away from his 29th birthday. We got word the next day that the funeral would be held on the following Saturday in Regina, Saskatchewan. The Rangers were sending the team plane. I was not the captain of the Rangers, but I was privy to the same type of information that the team leaders would receive because John Rosasco, the Rangers PR guy, told me when I was asking him about travel arrangements and who was going to go pay their respects to Boogie. By Wednesday, I noticed that the headcount of Ranger players attending Derek's funeral was at 6. 6? I sat on the patio of Tiny's, shocked and angry. I lit a cigarette and hit slats on my speed dial list. The boss answered with his signature, "Hello." I told Glenn that I was upset because as of right now, we had 6 Rangers confirmed to attend the funeral. And if this was how it shook out, it would be the most shameful thing to happen to the Rangers organization. He told me to call Drew, Chris Drury, and tell him that every Ranger player living in North America should be at that funeral on Saturday. Nobody stepped out of line with Slats. And if they did, then he would simply make a few calls and you were ancient history. The moment I realized Hillary would always be more important than hockey was a few minutes after the Rangers PR man, John Rosasco, told me that John Tortorella wasn't going to attend Derek Bugard's funeral. I was sick to my stomach. And she was there to console me and give me support, which helped stop me from doing something that could have landed me in prison. I have never felt more hatred towards someone in my life than I felt toward Tortorella at that moment. It was more of a shock than when I heard Derek had died. And it made me wonder, who was going to be there at the end? There might be no one, and I didn't want that. I wanted it to be the woman standing beside me now, and onward through the flames ahead, because nothing mattered but love. Tortorella's stated reason for missing the funeral was an inability to fly because of recent hip surgery. I can promise you right now that if I had been Tortorella and the doctors had told me not to fly, I would have taken a bus, which Mr. Dolan would have surely paid for, with whatever physiotherapist needed to make the trip to Regina, a 30-hour drive from New York City. A coach not attending his player's funeral is unheard of. But maybe it's just as well he wasn't there, since in my opinion, the appalling manner in which he'd treated Derek after he was injured had been a factor in Derek's decline and death. The night before we flew to Saskatchewan, a bunch of Rangers came back to town, and we all went out to Roseland Ballroom. Not to drown our sorrows, but because there was a DJ playing, Armin van Buuren, who the guys liked and wanted to see. The next morning on the team plane, some of the Rangers were still high on ecstasy. I didn't care. At least they were going to say goodbye to their teammate, and if this is what it took, well, so be it. There were 40 Ranger players and personnel at Derek's funeral, but I know there would have been much fewer had I not called Slats and told him what was about to happen. The day after Boogie died, Aaron Voros and I went and cleaned out his Manhattan apartment on 58th Street and 9th Avenue, which he had sublet from Voros. There were empty pill and wine bottles all over the place. It looked like a warehouse of booze and drugs. I was surprised when Voros told me that the police had never talked to him. Derek's parents donated his brain to science, and tests came back saying Bugard had CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, that was so bad his brain was in worse shape than that of Bob Probert, who recently had died at age 45. If Boogie had lived to middle age, he would have had dementia. His parents also launched a lawsuit against the NHL, saying the league and its drug policies and its celebration of enforcer culture led to their son's death. The suit was dismissed in 2017, but Derek was still dead, far too young. The damage could not be undone. The Rangers training camp for the 2011-2012 season was very different for me than the one 10 years earlier, when I made the Red Wings and the NHL. This time, I came into camp in the best shape of my life, and I was faster, too. I had taken up tennis over the summer as part of my training regime, and I found that I loved the game. It has a lot of similarities to hockey, in that you have to anticipate where the tennis ball is going to land in the court, just like you have to anticipate where the puck is going to go on the ice. Playing tennis in your head is like playing a virtual chess match, where every move you make is about the next move coming. And the beauty of it all is that you need to make the decision as you're moving and growing tired. So you have to play smart. And the more you play, the more you start to see patterns. Playing tennis is like solving one big geometry problem. But I have another problem to solve, and it looks like it's beyond my control. I have never been concerned about starting training camp on the fourth line. But when camp starts and I'm on the fifth line, I know I'm done. Slowly but surely, Tortorella has done to me what he's done to so many of my teammates, chipped away all meaning from me and my game. But I get a chance at redemption, or revenge, or a bit of both. This year, we're going to play our second half of training camp in Europe. We land in Prague, and after a quick drive to the team hotel, all the players are exiting the buses to a horde of fans wanting autographs and pictures. There are groupies there too, who, after taking a photo with you, hand you an envelope with a note inside about what exactly they'd like to do